And on RN, you're with Michael Cathcart. Well, I was watching the Olympics last night. It's hard not to watch them. I suppose most of us are getting into it. Maybe you're feeling a bit distant from it all. I guess everyone has their own take on all this. But if you feel the need to get into the spirit and you're in Melbourne, there's an exhibition on in that city that should do the trick. It's called A Call to the Games, and it's on at the marvellous National Sports Museum, which is in the MCG, which of course was the site for the Melbourne Olympics back in 1956. It's a remarkable collection of original Olympic promotional posters on loan from London's Victorian Albert Museum. These artworks range from the very earliest rather obscure games in the mid-19th century through wars of the years of war and protest right up until the present. As James Patterson discovered, behind these posters, there are stories of intrigue and controversy.
Hi, my name is Jed Smith. I'm from the National Sports Museum and I'm the manager of the collections and the exhibitions.
What is it about this exhibition that gets you going?
It's sport and art. It sounds obvious, but whenever you get art into a museum or a gallery context and you get different people observing, viewing, debating, you get passionate opinions. We have some amazing stuff in our permanent displays, but everybody loves Don Brabham's Baggy Green. You just don't get anyone saying, oh, I wish it was blue, or, you know, I wish it was made of Velcro. Those same divergences of opinion don't exist. But when you get art in a museum, that's when you get people getting very heated and very passionate, and that's disgusting, or that's ridiculous, or that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. The modern Olympic movement started in the 1890s. Pierre de Coubertin, a Frenchman, had this grand vision of breathing life back into the ancient games of the Greeks. He saw it as a way of bringing people together at a time when, especially in Europe, it was all about national borders and strength and navies and what eventually became the build-up to the First World War. A lot of antagonism, a bad time. Throughout Britain, there had been mini Olympic games, local villages getting together and competing and racing. Those were the games that gave him that influence. One of these posters is from Much Wenlock, a small town in Shropshire in England. Wenlock is one of the names of the two mascots for the 2012 Games.
So we're looking here at two bills from 1851, I see here, and they both look like the front cover of a newspaper. Yeah. It's black and white, big, bold writing, Dover's Meeting, 1851. Maybe you can read it for me.
The good old times will be revived with a spirit of clarity and a generous subscription to the amusement of Her Majesty's subjects, commencing at 2 o'clock with 24 belts to be wrestled for. So it's beautiful language. It's a gorgeous piece of iconography from before the modern Olympics. Everyone thinks of 1896, Athens, the first modern games, but its history and traditions are much older. We're looking at a poster from 1900, the second modern Olympics in Paris. It's a large yellow poster, beautiful red, crimson text. And we're looking at a very attractive young girl. She's holding three rapiers for fencing. She's standing there in all of almost 5 foot in real size. She's selling the fact that the fencing competition is taking place around the corner from this location. It's beautiful because, on many reasons, first of all, it's a beautiful piece of artwork. Secondly, it was revolutionary. Something this size, in bright colours, in comparison to the 19th century posters that sit next to it, would have been the equivalent of colour television suddenly switching on. It would have blown people's minds. These posters weren't cheap. And there's actually a stamp, which is very hard to see, but it's against the side of her head, saying in French something to the extent of, if you are caught in possession of this poster for your personal use, you will be prosecuted. I.e., once this is on a wall, it has to stay there because it's too expensive to replace. This is the modern commercial world coming into life in front of our eyes. This is the beginning of that process.
So this is a very different style that we're looking at here, the Olympic Games in Stockholm in 1912. What are we looking at? There is a lot of colour in this poster.
This is the first official Olympic poster to send around the world to say, hey, the Games are coming, join us. So up until this point, posters were produced to sell parts of the Games or particular sports or even transport posters telling you how to get to the Games. It depicts some idealised male figures, pretty much nude, holding enormous flags and banners which they're waving in a sequence, in a line. The beauty of this poster is the front centre athlete, who's holding a very large Swedish flag, as you'd expect for Stockholm, has some adornments. He has some streamers that adorn his person in a very private place.
It's very well placed. This is quite a raunchy poster.
It is, and this is the key problem. This poster originally didn't have those streamers adorning the athletes, and sure enough, it didn't get the tick to go through and be the official poster. Despite being censored, the poster was still banned in about 8 different countries across the world. On the left-hand side as I look, we have two posters relating to the 1936 Games. The Summer Games and the Winter Games were both held in Germany, in Berlin, and down in Bavaria, right in the middle of the Nazi regime. Germany is fascist. The Games are fascist. They are created and supported to underpin that Nazi idealism. So very, very strong, bombastic images. Big black and red colours. Strong males with rippling muscles, looking upwards. And when we look at the winter poster especially, we see a skier. He's got a white pinned vest on with the 5 Olympic rings. But interestingly, it's what he's doing with his right arm, which is mostly out of shot, which could easily, and has very often been suggested to have been a Nazi salute.
And looking at the poster for the 1936 Summer Games here, you have the coloured Olympic rings on the top and two images forged together. There's a gold man who looks not unlike an Oscar, an Academy Award.
He does, yes, absolutely. He looks like he's a statue. He's got a raised arm. It's off the page, so it can't be seen clearly. He's overseeing and overlooking the top of the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. The top of the Brandenburg Gate has lots of great early German and Prussian symbolism. It's got the eagle, it's got a Celtic cross. It's got all this relationship with German imperialism. It doesn't take a lot of leap of imagination to see that this is about celebrating German nationhood and aligning it with the ancient Greeks, the idea of empire, the idea of having a place in the pantheon of great nations over time.
And what do we have here above these 1936 Olympic posters?
Well, it's actually a third 1936 Olympics poster, but it couldn't be more different. And what we're looking at is the rival games to Berlin. People in 36 weren't blind to what was going on in Nazi Germany. Some of those who didn't want to be seen to be underpinning the Nazi regime actually set up their rival games. And they set up a games in Barcelona, where the Republican movement was very strong at that time. It looks entirely different in the design aesthetic. Rather than the single strong male, the Aryan male, as per the Nazi ideology, you have three figures all clutching the same flag together. They're in different colours. We have a red and a black and a yellow depicted person, different coloured T-shirts, different colour skin tones. That's the inference. And then they're holding a flag called Popular Olympics. The problems start 3 days before the Games kick off in Barcelona when the Spanish Civil War breaks out. They actually took arms, many of them. So you have people who'd gone to Barcelona to run and jump and catch, and suddenly they're taking arms and shooting at nationalists.
We've just walked past the Melbourne poster from 1956, and there's a really striking difference between the Melbourne poster. It's this pretty bare kind of poster, and the earlier posters showing some rippling athletes.
You've touched on a really key point. This is a designer called Richard Beck, and what Richard Beck does in 56 is he totally tears up the rule book. There has been a standard Olympic poster through most of the previous games. As you say, it talks to the Athenian games, the rippling muscles, the statuesque men, the sinews being strained. What Richard Beck decides to produce is a simple plain blue background, simple bold text, Olympic Games, Melbourne, the dates, and then this weird floating white shape, which is actually an invitation card. It's an invitation for you to come along and join in the games. The Olympic 5 rings on the front of the card and the City of Melbourne crest on the back of the card. And that's it. There's not a single human figure, which is the first thing that makes it quite unique in the run of posters. And it's a beautiful contrast because in 56, the equestrian games, the horses weren't allowed into Australia because of various quarantine regulations at that time. So for the very first time, the 56 Summer Games actually took place in two countries. So the equestrian was in Stockholm. And the poster for that Stockholm version of the games is to the left. What you do have is the Greek frieze of a statuesque Athenian male on a horse, right back to the traditional accepted Greek poster for the Greek origin Olympic Games.
And it doesn't have an envelope because horses don't have opposable thumbs and couldn't open them up.
Absolutely. I've never really thought of it that way, but that's beautiful. So what happened in Melbourne was revolutionary. It was a modernist design. It was groundbreaking. and it spoke a lot about what was happening in Australia at that time artistically and architecturally.
But this is where things get crazy again.
We're looking at a series of posters relating to Mexico in 68. By now, there isn't just one official poster. There are a series of posters. What they went with as the official poster, the number one official poster, was what we're looking at ahead of us.
That is incredible.
How would you? I wouldn't know how to begin to describe that.
It's almost like a magic eye. When your eyes have adjusted, you can see Mexico somewhere amongst thousands of black outlines around the world.
The edge of the letters is then expanded beyond, like a ripple effect, like you've dropped a stone in a glass of water, and it just goes out, out, out. And so it's very hard to see what's actually in the middle. And it's square. Who the hell has heard of a square poster in 1968? Posters aren't square, they're portraits, size and scale. Not only that, you then get them reproducing it. That's black, essentially, black and white. They then reproduce it Andy Warhol style in seven or eight different colours. Like your soup cans.
It kind of looks like these two square posters that we have here could be record covers from 1968.
Absolutely. So this was absolutely cutting edge. It's op art in 1968 being used by what we consider perhaps to be a old school, old man, blazer, glass of port, committee structure, organisation. But they're not. That poster couldn't have been produced the year before. It wouldn't have existed. It's the Olympic poster at the cutting edge of design, and that's quite incredible. When Pierre de Coubertin had his concept for the Olympic movement, he wasn't thinking of it as a sporting occasion. His vision was of the human race as being strong physically, but also strong mentally, emotionally, artistically. So in the early games, while he was still alive, he arranged for there to be gold medal and bronze and silver medals awarded for sculpture, painting, poetry, artwork, as well as for running, jumping, shooting, climbing, wrestling. And when someone approached him and said, well, how can you possibly award a gold medal for something that's subjective, you know, which is the best artwork, which is the best sculpture? He said, I understand there's problems with this concept, but if you pull out the artwork from my Olympic movement, all you're left with is a sporting event. And what value does that have? He saw a very fit body without a trained mind as being dangerous. He saw a very trained mind without a fit body as being a waste. He saw that both art and sport were important and necessary to live side by side. And in the modern Olympic movement, a lot of that art is gone. The last vestiges of Pierre de Coubertin's original concept are in the Olympic posters, where you still find that artistic movement and that association with art.
The fun bit. Mm. If you could take one of these posters home, Jed, what is your favourite piece of art?
Okay, we're standing in front of a poster from 1921. This is an unofficial Olympic Games, a workers' Olympic in Prague, in opposition to the official games where it was felt those who could afford it went. Didn't last long, didn't have a great deal of success, but the imagery, I just love that aesthetic. He's a gentleman with trousers on, he's a labourer, he's holding, it seems, in his right hand a very large pick or a hammer. He's got that muscly Greek thing, but it's not muscles in the sculptured way of the Acropolis or of David. This is the muscles you might see on someone who works at the coalface. This is about the reality of the working man. You've got chimneys in the background belching out smoke. The iconography is just simple. It's red, it's black, it's white. For someone who's standing there with his top off and is very muscly, it's actually very feminized. His lips are very bright and red, and his gaze is very gentle and humane. And again, part of that whole movement was coming together, not fighting, and togetherness for the class struggle, not for the struggle between nations, which are falsely imposed. That's the concept. And it says all of that. And I love it as a piece of decorative art, and I love it as a piece of history.